Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. The Feast of All Saints honours the obscure as well as the famous, the saints each of us has known. An initiative of daily solidarity for the poor and the homeless of the city shines the light on the sad predicament of many, day in and day out. And Father Jim Brand speaks about the Feast of the Holy Souls and meditates on the fact that November is really a month of thanksgiving. Today the Church celebrates all the saints, canonized or beatified, and the multitude of those who are in heaven. During the early centuries, the saints venerated by the Church were all martyrs. Later on, the Pope set November the 1st as the day for commemorating all the saints. It's a feast that should inspire us with hope. Among the saints in heaven are some whom we have known. All lived on earth, lives like our own. They were baptized, marked with the sign of faith. They were faithful to Christ's teaching. It's also a good day to remember a saint that maybe brought particular inspiration to your life, like St. Martin de Porres, who earned himself the name of Martin of Charity for his devotion to his work, no matter how menial.
He excused the faults of others. He forgave the bitterest injuries, convinced that he deserved much severer punishments on account of his own sins. He tried with all his might to redeem the guilty. Lovingly, he comforted the sick. He provided food, clothing, and medicine for the poor. He helped, as best he could, farm laborers and Negroes, as well as mulattoes, who were looked upon at that time as akin to slaves. Thus, he deserved to be called by the name the people gave him, Martin of Charity.
These are the words Pope John XXIII chose to remember St. Martin de Porres when he canonized him in 1962. The humble servant of God, whose feast day we celebrate on November the 3rd, was born in Peru in 1579. He was the illegitimate son of a Spanish nobleman and a young freed black slave and grew up in poverty. Aged 11, he became a servant in the Dominican Priory in Lima, where he begged more than $2,000 a week from the rich to support the poor and the sick. Placed in charge of the Dominican's infirmary, known for his tender care of the sick and for his spectacular cures, his superiors dropped the stipulation that no black person may be received to the holy habit or profession of the order, and Martin took vows as a Dominican brother. He established an orphanage and children's hospital for the poor children of the slums. He set up a shelter for the stray cats and dogs. Martin lived in self-imposed austerity and spent much time in prayer and meditation. Saint Martin de Porres was, and still is, a much-loved saint, as my friend Father Peter Fleetwood told me. A saint with a rather special characteristic, and with a lesson of particular value in this day and age.
I think most of the time, when you look at saints in the mission lands, you're looking at people who've gone from Europe to these faraway places to bring religion with them.
Monsignor Peter Fleetwood is a former Vatican official at the Pontifical Council for Culture, and an expert on Muslim relations in Europe.
To bring God with them almost, which is a mad idea, because they always taught us in the catechism lessons, where is God? God is everywhere. I think you don't bring God with you. You might bring perhaps an awareness of God with you. But in this case, Martin was from Peru. He was a local boy, I suppose. So there you have a case where the Church recognised the holiness of somebody from that situation, rather than saying, giving them the idea that some people have sometimes said that the only people who ever get made saints are the ones who've come from headquarters, so to speak. So here you have someone, a real Peruvian, a real Christian, and somebody who's won the hearts of an incredible number of people throughout the world. I know that even my dad has a great devotion to him, maybe because it's on his birthday, the feast. But I don't think it's just that. And then if I think of my own home diocese of Liverpool, one of the nicest chapels in the whole cathedral, which is a very modern building, is the chapel devoted to Martin de Porres. And it's there because our priests who work in the South American mission are entrusted to the spiritual care of St. Martin, really. And on or about St. Martin's Day, the Liverpool Archdiocesan Missionary Project, LAMP for short, they have a massive collection in the diocese. I say massive because they have lots of collections, but this is the biggest one in terms of people's response. They automatically respect what is done in South America for people in very poor parts of very big countries, and Martin is their patron.
It must make a difference also to the people who are receiving his message. I mean, if somebody from your own background, from your own culture, comes to you with a message, it must make a difference to you. It must have a different impact as opposed to somebody who comes from outside, from a whole different world, with a whole different culture. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, and I think that's over the last century there's been canonizations of people from some places where we Europeans probably don't even know how to say the names properly, like Andrew Dung Lak, the saints who are patrons of Korea, Vietnam. They're all martyrs from there. They've been the Ugandan martyrs for some time. Even people in the Pacific who were homegrown saints. You know, so you have to say, why not? And that's a good thing, because they'll see we have grown into the faith. The faith has grown into our national culture. It's not just something imported. One thing that used to disturb me a lot when I was working in Rome for the Council for Culture was how many bishops' conferences would come from distant parts of the globe and say, we're still perceived as purveyors of a European ideology. What we bring is a European religion. On a silly level, one could say, well, it began in Asia anyway, because that's where the Holy Land is. But I know what they mean. They're treated by the local religious majority. I suppose any weapon can be used to make them feel a minority and make them feel out of place. And to accuse them of being European is one of the worst things that could be said to them. But it is, and they feel it's hard for them.
Is this what we call enculturation?
That word is probably out of fashion. I know the Pope prefers interculturality, and I think I see what he's on about, because enculturation can be putting certain principles onto a culture, adding something to a culture, or changing the message in order to make it acceptable to that culture. But if it's an interculturality, I think there's a possibility of the cultures getting to know each other, getting to learn from each other, which is that's the big miracle, that's the big challenge, I think, is when both sides say, I've got something to learn. You know, and even Christianity from one part of the world might say, yes, our faith is the faith in a way, but if I go abroad to a culture I don't know, maybe there's something there for me to discover about my faith. There's a paradox there. And I think people like Martin de Porres just are there as little reminders at the back of our minds. You do have something to learn. You haven't got all the answers.
You've been listening to our longtime friend, Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, an expert in cultural matters. The tradition of solidarity is high on the agenda here in Rome, also thanks to the goodwill and to the good work of the St. Egidio community, a movement of lay people dedicated to evangelization and charity. Yes, St. Egidio runs one of the city's largest soup kitchens, a much-needed service for so many people, Italian and non, who don't even know where their next meal is coming from. And the more we see people looking in rubbish bins in search of something to eat, the more we must realise that food, or the lack of it, is one of the most serious poverty problems of so many of our neighbours, right here, even in Europe's richest cities. And Rome is no exception. The vertiginous rise in the cost of living and the hundreds of thousands of penniless migrants and refugees in search of a better life are the main reasons there are more and more people out there on our streets every day with an empty stomach. I've often thought of signing up as a volunteer at a soup kitchen. It's a simple thing that anyone can do, but I never have. I have, however, met someone who has done just that. He's Benedictine monk Timothy Wright. And when he's not globetrotting for the work he does for interreligious dialogue, he's off to the soup kitchen at Sant'Egidio, here in Rome.
First of all, I was invited by one of the sisters here who goes every week, and I thought, I've always, and wherever I've been, I've always wanted to do something which was to help poor people, to help the disadvantaged, whatever way it was. And this seemed to be an obvious thing. Friday afternoon, go down to the Sant'Egidio in Trastevere and to work. And I didn't know what to expect, but sister said, come on, so off I went.
The community of Sant'Egidio, by the way, is a movement of lay people dedicated to evangelisation and charity. Since its beginning in 1988, the soup kitchen has given hospitality to more than 100,000 people and has served 2,200,000 meals.
And you turn up and we arrive, at buses permitting, at about 4:10, and we have 45 minutes to set the room up, which means getting the tables set up, chairs down, tables, places laid for the two rooms, each of which will take about 100 people. Then, around about 4:45, the door's opening at 5 o'clock, the other volunteers will start to arrive who are going to help out on the tables. And they're coming from largely from the religious houses. In the session that I do, they come from the religious houses in Rome. Nuns, sisters, seminarians, priests, superiors, lay people, men and women. It's a wonderful mix of people, and you gradually get to know them. 5 o'clock, the people come in, the men and women come in, mainly men, but there are a few women who come. Having gone through a process of registration and questioning and help by the Sant'Egidio community.
I was curious to hear exactly what goes on.
Basically, they come in, they sit down, and it's slightly complicated because the meal operates on a system whereby there are two courses. So when one person sits at your table, whoever is, you immediately go and serve them. You don't wait till the table fills up. And the person will sit down and you go primo secondo, which means do you want the pasta and do you want the main course? To which the answer usually is yes, primo secondo. So you go over to the serving area, you pick up a basket with two pieces of bread in it, a piece of fruit, and then you go and collect a plate of pasta and a piece of, which can be meat and vegetables or something like that. And you take it to them and you give it to them. And that is the meal that they have. They may ask for soup in place of pasta, or they may ask for formaggio, which is a block of cheese, instead of the secondo, or any permutation of the various options. And they come in regularly, and they're coming from a huge variety of backgrounds.
Father Timothy told me that the attention to the dignity and to the personality of everybody is expressed in the care of the environment and in the courteous attitude of the volunteers serving at the table. And he said, particular attention is paid to the meal that considers the eating habits of the guests with respect to their religious tradition. For example, in consideration of the presence of Muslims, pork or wine are never served.
What struck me immediately was I thought, well, the homeless people in Rome, when I first arrived, being quite ignorant, I thought, well, the homeless people in Rome won't be such a big problem. Rome's a nice city. The Catholic Church is pretty active, should be getting its act together. Example to the world. Well, I was amazed, A, the number of poor people you find around Rome.
A lot of old people, aren't there?
A lot of old people, but also some very handicapped people. I've seen people going around on skateboards because they've got no feet. And I myself, being not an expert here in Rome, will ask the question, you know, well, why can't we do something more for them? And there is one answer, which is there is quite a lot that goes on, and it's a question of going to the right place. Anyway, when they come into Sant'Egidio, and these are young people, older people, and people who've been coming for years, people who know the system, and live a wandering life. And some of them, you can tell, are very relaxed when they come in. They look at you, you greet them, and when you get to know them, you chat a bit, and they recognise you. Others, you come in and they're much more obviously recently here, worried about their future, worried about what's happening. Come and sit down. The prima facie, no, yes, fine. And you give them what they want. You smile with them, welcome them, etc. But it's, you sense that there's a distance there and there's an anxiety. Others, you sit down, once you start talking, you suddenly discover that, like me, not very fluent in Italian, and so they prefer to speak English. And they will come from countries in Africa, Eritrea. I've had one or two from Ethiopia, and I met one or two from Sierra Leone and other parts of Africa. And you can get into quite, for a little, because it's quite a busy time, you can't have a long conversation, but you can have a little bit of a conversation.
I can imagine that a lot of them might want to talk. I mean, a lot of them must be very lonely.
I think so, but I, on the other hand, you do get the impression that a number of them are quite friendly to each other. They come in sort of groups and they sit down. And I would imagine, though, that a lot of them are probably... I mean, this is what I don't know, but once you arrive and you've got nowhere to go and the whole question of whether you're legal or not legal, that's an issue which I'm not an expert in. But if you are not got quite got the right papers yet, it must be quite a lonely business. And I think the St. Egidio community are doing their best to try and help people in order to facilitate that sort of thing.
Do you see people who maybe have led quite an ordinary life? I mean, they've always been poor, but they've managed to survive. And now maybe they're old and their pensions don't cover expenses. Yeah. And they find themselves in the predicament of having to go to a soup kitchen. Do you find people like that?
I think
can it happen to anyone?
It can happen to anyone. And some of the people you look at, you say to yourself, because they look a very different sort of person, and perhaps they're coming because, as you say, they've fallen out, they haven't got enough money, they've lost their money, they're coming for to get a meal. Because the soup kitchen, I think, only operates Wednesdays, Fridays and Saturdays. And so they're providing a good meal three times a week. And it may be that that's enough to give them the bridge between not having anything at all, having just enough, and to sustain them for the other 3 days. But you do get... some people you see coming through, not that I've had any chance to talk to them, but you say, yes, well, you feel like saying, well, you probably had a wonderful life before and something has happened. And that's, I find that always very difficult and very sad.
That's something I learnt a few years ago when I did a series of programmes on street people. It can happen to anyone. It's so easy to fall through the cracks of society and find oneself on the edge, marginalised, lonely, and even hungry.
It must be a very sad job. Should we call it a job? No, it's not really a job, but it must be a sad, in a way, thing to do.
What the great gift of this, and I always talk in terms of gift, is that it makes me aware that there are a lot of people in our world who live lives as simple, as deprived as the people who come into the soup kitchen. And it makes one ask a lot of questions about the way we construct our system to help. And as I said earlier, I've travelled a little bit in various countries of the world, and everywhere you find that there is always the very small group who are phenomenally well off, a middle group who are okay, and then a bottom group who, you know, who are there because they can't get out of it. And at the end of the day, if the economy of the country is strong enough to give them jobs, a lot of them will get jobs and can go up the ladder. If it's not strong enough, they end up forming this group of people who, of course, you know, have a resentment, that they're not welcomed, they've been pushed out of their own country for survival. These are the people who migrate out of a country, we always have to remember, are always the more talented, because they're the ones who've got the get up and go and say, well, I've had enough of this, I'm going. And we'll cross mountains and take boats across seas and all this sort of thing. And the illegal immigrant, to use a phrase that is often spoken of, are the people who have got the energy, who have got the gifts, and have got the vision to say, I can't do any worse here. It's better for me to go. Now, in most countries, those people eventually will find a footstep and make their way up. But the people who, for one reason or another, don't get the right steps on the ladder, they often fall back to the bottom. And they're the people who so often are left behind.
And that's why he does it. Father Timothy told me it's not only to help these people and give them a sense there's some material help, but also to give them a sense of being worthy and valuable and lovable as they are. And now looking ahead to the Feast of the Holy Souls, celebrated each year on November the 2nd, Father Jim Brand meditates on the fact that November is really a month of thanksgiving.
Hello everyone, it's Father Jim here again. We've started November, which for me is always a special month when we think of the Holy Souls, those who've gone before us. We used to make a great fuss of the Holy Souls when I was in the parish. We'd visit all the cemeteries and the crematorium, and we'd ask the parishioners to let me know which cemetery and which grave, and we'd have at least 2 days, 2 Saturdays in this month, when I'd come round at the right time to the right graves, and the families would be there, and we'd say a little prayer of thanksgiving at each grave. And I was deeply moved by the love with which the family held those who died. It's a way of honouring your father and your mother, which is really the fourth commandment, to love one's history, to love the grace that's brought us safe thus far, and also to know that the loved one is in God's hands, because we're made for God, we're only lent to each other. And there were so many great achievements when families had helped their loved one in their labour pain to eternal life and helped them die peacefully. I also used to make a point of having a special pastoral care for the staff in the crematorium and in the cemetery. We used to have lots of coffees and times together, because that is a great corporal work of mercy. Also, when we had a funeral, I'd always have coffees and teas for the undertakers during the Mass. Otherwise, they'd be standing outside in the cold, wondering when Mass would be ended. That was greatly appreciated, because to be an undertaker, to be working in a cemetery, be working in a crematorium, well, it's a sad job. And they need real pastoral care and gratitude as well. There is nothing like a good undertaker, somebody who takes some of the cares and worries away from a bereaved family and they're not quite sure what they have to do next. Also, we would have special masses in November in gratitude for the Holy Souls. We'd have a nice book that I'd write up, and a little shrine of the Holy Souls. So this month I'm thinking of all those who mourn, that they will be comforted. I'm thinking with gratitude for all those people in our lives who were lent to us, all part of that grace that brought us safe thus far. And really it's a month of thanksgiving, gratitude for those who brought us into the world, who taught us, who fed us, who loved us. One of the sad things was that some of the services at the crematorium, if people didn't have anything to believe in, the speech at the crematorium wasn't to do with who that person is now, it's who that person was. Sort of trip down memory lane. He loved Handel's Largo. He used to say this. Just memories. There's one song by the Simon Garfunkel that made a great impression on me. It's rather a sad song. It's called Bookends. And these are the simple words. Time it was, and what a time it was, it was, it was. A time of innocence. A time of confidences. Long ago it must be, it must be. I have a photograph. Preserve your memories. That's all that's left you. Oh. As if the person we've loved is now a has-been. And if one doesn't believe in something better after this life, all you have is memories, and you have to laugh about death. At the local crematorium once, during a funeral service, they played the song, I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now. And they've had Knees Up Mother Brown as the coffin went through into the back part of the crematorium. One had to giggle. To me, that's very sad, because the person who's died isn't a has-been. That person is. And if all we have is our photographs, then we'll treat the picture of our Lord, which I believe is on the shroud, as the only thing we've got. I have a photograph. Preserve your memories. That's all that's left you. But the Lord is risen, and those in him are due to rise, and he's gone to prepare a place for them. So instead of just praying for the dead, we always prayed to them, because they're nearer God now than they ever could have been when they were on earth. So I hope the Holy Spirit, the Comforter, will come to you all if you are mourning. And after all, we're all mourning. We weren't found under a gooseberry bush. We've all been given life by somebody. And I hope you find these thoughts a comfort to you. I know throughout the world, in the Philippines, people travel a long way, even though they've just had a terrible typhoon, to go and try and visit the graves on November the 1st. So I hope for you all this will be a month of gratitude, knowing that those who've gone before us have reached home. And whatever they're doing in heaven, I presume they're polishing the silver, so as to welcome us one day. St. Teresa of Lisieux said she'd spent her heaven doing good on earth. Let's ask all those holy people to spend their heaven doing good to us today, as they did when they were with us. Amen.
Thanks there to Father Jim Brand for that reflection. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.